Hi, this is Marissa, and on this week's episode of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between, I am joined by Matthew Kaufman and Patrick Shelley from the Anti-Racist Alliance. Today, we will be discussing issues such as police reform, alternatives to policing, and alternatives to incarceration. I hope you enjoy. Before we begin, could you both introduce yourselves, maybe talk about your career, your background, and how that affects the work that you're doing now?
My name is Matthew. I am currently a social work student at Hunter. Getting a master's in social work. I wouldn't say I necessarily have a career, but my background in justice movement work started with food justice and slowly kind of expanded, you know, into the larger lens of racial justice. Did a lot of work learning about the impact of food and food systems on equity and the world that we live in. As I continued that work, I realized that a lot of the problems we're facing are much deeper and have a long history of racism, which is kind of how I got into learning about racism through the Undoing Racism workshop, getting involved with the Anti-Racist Alliance, and is the majority of the reason why I'm getting a social work degree.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm a social worker here in Westchester County. I've been working in the field of youth mental health services for quite a while now. And in my experiences, I've gone through some trainings to help teach how to not only address racism that's within systems, but that's, you know, within the services that we provide to individuals and youth as well. So I received a training around 2013 on how to better our practice in working with youth receiving mental health services. And from there, just have really expanded kind of like into some different areas of focus when it comes to advocacy work and fighting for racial equity and opportunities for young people here in Westchester County. So that's how Matthew and I have kind of joined together too, is to address focus around youth justice reform and really transitioning out of the traditional models of punishment, which would be like incarceration of youth, to more holistic and nurturing approaches to work with problematic behaviors that are identified in young people.
So what exactly does the Anti-Racist Alliance strive to accomplish, and how does it go about achieving its goals?
I'm gonna read you what they have on their website. It's like a short thing. The Anti-Racist Alliance is a movement for racial equity. We are an organizing collective of human service practitioners and educators whose vision is to bring a clear and deliberate anti-racist structural power analysis to social service education and practice. Basically, it is a network of organizers. So Patrick and I are both involved in Westchester's network of the Anti-Racist Alliance. There's one in Rockland, there's one in New Jersey, there might be a few more. But basically, we have a monthly meeting where a bunch of people who have gone through anti-racist training and are majorly, like, I don't like the term helping professionals, but I mean, they're in some sort of service to people. The goal of it is to promote racial equity. And there's a lot of different ways that we can try to do that. But the first, I think, and most important is really having an understanding of the structure of racism that this country is built around. So a lot of the work that we do is to uplift the Undoing Racism training run by the People's Institute in order to help people get that education. And then once people take the workshop and graduate from it, they can get involved in any sort of different organizing that's going on or start their own organizing. And it's just kind of a lens to view structural racism through.
Great, thank you. Could you just explain what the People's Institute is and what its training looks like?
So the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond is a 40-year-old-ish organization based out of New Orleans. And they got together and had an analysis of racism and started teaching it. And so Patrick and I are both graduates from the Undoing Racism Workshop, which is a 2.5-day intensive training and go through their curriculum for understanding racism.
So how do programs like these make real change other than just attracting supporters and spreading awareness for issues such as racism and police injustices?
I could touch base on that a little bit. Just to give you a little bit of perspective, there was a group of organizers that we collaborated for the city of White Plains to meet with the mayor of White Plains and a few other leadership staff from the White Plains Police Department to address some concerns that we had. And this was even before the executive order placed by Governor Cuomo to address police re-transformation and police services to do a reform. He did a statewide executive order for reform, right? So this was before that, but we did meet with them. And the group of us that met with him included people that have gone through this training with People's Institute and that have this similar like-minded goal to address racial disparities that plague our communities, that really impact the communities. So who gets arrested the most in White Plains? It's people of color. Who, like, for when it comes to youth, who gets arrested the most? It's undocumented and people of color. So these are like key topics that we focused on and we knew that we were going to address just going into our conversation with the mayor. Luckily, a couple of us have been able to sit on the police reform committee as well and address these things. So when we're addressing topics like police training, when we're addressing topics like police accountability and transparency, we're thinking about this all the way through. We're making sure that we address not only racial disparities, but working with the LGBTQ community, working with the undocumented community. So all these really, really important issues that have to do with equality and justice and a better life for everyone, we're making sure we address that in all of our recommendations. We're going to have to see how it goes with our recommendations to the state and to the City Council of White Plains. But, this is our way of trying to do the best job we can to address these things in a larger situation where we're advocating for systems change.
So what change have you accomplished and what change do you still hope to achieve?
It's a really hard question to answer, right? It's very hard to see accomplishment, at least from where I sit. My internship put me working with the Anti-Racist Alliance and with Patrick. So I've been at this internship for maybe 5-6 months now, and it changes really slow. My supervisor says to me almost every week, this is a marathon, not a sprint. To see real legislative change takes a long time. And the policies that govern, who the police are allowed to target and arrest, for example, they're protected by a lot. They're protected by police unions. They're protected by the police who don't want to see this change. They're protected by communities that have been taught to be scared, right? So when you say change, like, what are you talking about? Are you talking about like the change of mentality? Because I think in the past, year, the conversations that we've been having are completely different than conversations we were having 10 years ago about white supremacy and structural racism like that, that we never really saw before. So that's a big change. I don't know, Patrick, you want to, anything?
Yeah, definitely. I could definitely agree with what Matthew's saying. It's sometimes you feel like you're waiting a long time to see the change that you want to see happen. But when it comes to police transformation, there were a lot of things that were passed in New York State last year. A lot of major changes. But a lot of times when you're focused on a very specific thing, like Matthew and I are really focused on alternatives to incarceration for young people. Now, it's something that I've been working on a bit longer, but to say that we've now had conversations with legislators, we've had conversations with a representative for a senator, and really gathered the attention of elected officials in Westchester County and even outside of that, it is definitely an initial point of like success, right? Because we're planting little seeds. If people weren't even thinking about this before, but now they've had a conversation with Matthew or one of our other advocates on our team, and they're just thinking differently about how we treat young people, then that's a win, right? So it's a little bit, but we're still pushing for the big change. That's where research comes in. That's where young people and their voice comes in. And when we can, again, do more protesting outside and gathering together to advocate for these things. But those little things are wins. I see like those are the first steps to that change that we really want to see happen.
Yeah, I want to also lift up. So another woman we work with, Anne Behringer Spaeth, has been organizing around juvenile justice for 50 years in Westchester. And her goal the entire time has to see Woodfield Cottage, the Westchester's youth detention center, get shut down. And it hasn't been shut down yet. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been change, right? That doesn't mean that her 50 years of organizing hasn't impacted people and helped with alternatives and provided resources and all these things. And Woodfield Cottage is still up and running. So like Patrick said, when you're focused on one goal and that goal still hasn't happened, it can be very difficult to be like, oh, there actually has been, you know, we have impacted a lot of people in a positive way. Because sometimes that's just really hard to see because your main focus is not something that's happened yet.
Great, thank you. Moving on now. All the questions I'm asking today are based off a survey we sent to our youth group. One of the questions we received is, quote, why as a white person should I change my behavior because I haven't done anything actively racist? How would you respond to this question and this perspective in general?
After going through the training that Matthew and I have been through, our perspective is very different. But when you are silent in these situations of injustice, you are perpetuating the problem just as much as the person that is overtly doing the acts of hate, acts of violence, the people that did what they did at the Capitol, people that carry their signs or wave their flags. If you're just sitting back and you're silent about certain things, then you are doing a lot of harm as well. Now, some people, you know, may argue that, but it really does take action to be anti-racist. You have to take action. You have to be mindful. If something is happening while you're out on the street and you stick up for somebody and you record the situation, you're taking action. Ibram Kendi's definition of being anti-racist is not just that you are pushing for policy change, for anti-racist policies, but it's also in your actions. And you can't get more in depth than that. You really have to take action against these injustices.
For me to hear, I haven't done anything actively racist, has a very narrow definition of what racism is. We are taught in this country to be racist without realizing we're being racist. There are a lot of similarities, I think, between, and I don't want to say they're the same, right, between racism and anti-Semitism. But we can draw from those lessons, especially because I think your audience is mostly Jewish, correct?
Yes, yeah.
So my grandfather had to flee from Austria when the Nazis invaded. And something he said to me many times growing up, it's not a matter of people doing harm to others, but the people who are not doing harm sitting idly by, right, and letting it happen. Now, there were so many more people that let the Holocaust happen than those who actually committed the crime. And that is, I think, very relevant in this person's question. You know, as a white person, you might not realize that you are letting racism happen, but the system was built so that you benefit from racism. We all do.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify too, it doesn't take a 2.5-day training to be fully anti-racist. This is an ongoing process. It's something that I will be working on and learning throughout my whole life and throughout my whole profession on how to be better at it, how to be more anti-racist than I was last year or yesterday in an action or inaction that I did or didn't do. So this truly is a lifelong process for white people to do a better job and stand up for equal treatment of all other humans.
Race is a sensitive issue, but it clearly cannot be ignored. I feel that I have to point out to our listeners that both of you are white. How does it feel to be a white person working for an organization to help people of color combat racism? White people have a privilege that separates us from truly understanding the struggles and depth of racism. What I'm trying to ask is, as a white person, do you feel that your perspective of the struggles that people of color face is flawed and biased? And how do you account for this in your work?
That's a really good question. I'll definitely touch base on it. So in our training that we took, we learn about our everyday role to be a gatekeeper. And that can mean a lot of things. So I'm a director of a youth program. So yes, in a lot of ways, I can gatekeep and determine how things go within the one youth program that I work with here in Westchester County. You could also be a gatekeeper in how you act when you behave to just go to the deli and pick up your sandwich and your coffee in the morning. So there's just a lot of ways that you can be a gatekeeper. But for my specific example, a way that I can do that in helping others is making sure that anything that I do when it comes to not only the activities that we plan for children, but the way that we implement policies and procedures for the staff of our program, that I'm doing this with a diverse group of people, that I am not the only one making this decision, that I am inclusive, that I talk to my assistant director, who's an amazing, intelligent Black woman who I do trainings with, that we collaborate on these things together, that I don't just put my foot down and say, I'm making this decision. We do it as a collective. And I feel like that, including surveying our families, asking, getting feedback on how our services are, talking to the children about the services that they receive, asking them what they prefer to do, and taking on a child's strengths and including that into the services they receive is really important. So it goes from that independent, kind of like the staff working with the child, all the way to us up in administration, working together as a collective versus just kind of telling people what to do or what's good for them.
Yeah, that's, I'm learning about how community organizing is a different way of leading than what we're normally used to seeing leaders as. We're used to seeing leaders as a CEO, someone's boss, right? It's one person decision making. And that's very, very common way of leadership. And community organizing tries to change that perspective by including a lot of people's voices and, you know, not making decision based on one person's perspective. And there's many different ways to making decisions in a group, and they're not always easy, right? It's much easier for me to say, like, this is the way we're doing it, and that's final, than, you know, taking in four different considerations that might contradict each other. But that process of learning together and compromising and consenting to a path forward causes, in general, much less harm than one person making decision. And that's kind of the most important in decision making.
Thank you for that response. And now moving on to a different topic. Many people my age look at all of these systemic injustices and really want to help, but they don't know how to get involved in social justice work. What can young people who cannot vote do to take on racism and other injustices?
The first step is learning. And there's a lot of resources out there, a lot of books, a lot of videos to start learning about what racism looks like, bigger than just individual acts of aggression and harm. And there's trainings, and there, you know, we talk to people and be in conversation with folks. So that's a really good first step, I think. And after that is getting involved, figuring out what there is in your communities, that what organizations are working to address harm, and speaking up when you see things that might not be taking everything into account, right? Like, it's very easy to have good intentions and the impact is harmful. And I've seen it a lot. I'm sure, Patrick, you've seen it a lot, right? It's very difficult to be the only person speaking up in a situation like that, because everyone's like, yeah, this feels great, we're doing good work. And you're like, hold on, like, what's the impact of what we're doing? There's a lot, and it's also hard, right? It requires being uncomfortable a lot of the time, especially when you're white. It means recognizing and sitting with your own whiteness.
So I guess I would just say it ranges across the board. It does. Education is really, really important. But the gentleman that I was speaking of before, Ibram Kendi, who wrote the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, he actually said this himself, and it's so true. A lot of times what white people want to do when they want to start taking action is start a book discussion group, right? Now, that's really important. Like Matthew said, learning is definitely number one, top of the list, something you got to do. But it's also in the action of what you do after that. It's in about addressing policy change and transformation with your local legislators or senators. It's your daily interactions. It's having difficult conversations with your family or friends or coworkers about these things. So it's on the micro level, it's those things. And then on a macro level, it's the really, like, you know, going to protests, doing all these efforts to create systemic change are really, really important. But it's definitely both. You need to learn, but then you definitely need to take that action next.
We focused on police injustices for the vast majority of this podcast. Could you talk a little bit about how policing and racism intersect? What role does anti-racism play in combating systemic racism in policing?
Policing and racism intersect a long, long, long time ago. We're talking hundreds of years ago, when racism was first introduced as a concept to justify slavery, which essentially was, you know, a way of saying Black people are inferior, and so it's okay for us to put them through slavery. And the policing aspect were the white indentured servants who got permission to enforce slavery. And that has kind of grown throughout the years through the abolition of slavery, through the abolition of segregation, to what it is today. Like, it has very, very deep roots. Addressing policing is, I think, really questioning why we have a system of punishment. If we're really out to heal harms and take accountability for the harms we have caused, punishment is not necessarily the best way to go about doing that. I think many people who are anti-racist might agree that it is not the best way to go about doing that. You know, to take accountability and to heal harms requires the ability to act and show that you're sorry. So when we put people in prison, that takes away that ability from them. Patrick, you want to add to that?
Policing in America was developed and expanded for a very specific reason. And it's what led to, you know, these different eras throughout time where our leaders of the country actually pushed agendas to fight crime and to do these things that they thought was the right thing for whatever reason. But that's not necessarily the case. This was all designed to be oppressive. The age of mass incarceration is now. So now that's one of the things that we're working on addressing, is, you know, undoing all these things that people put in place. They put in place certain rules for police, which led to mass incarceration of people of color. So really, that's what it comes down to, is it's gonna take a large amount of advocacy and implementation of anti-racism and anti-racist principles into politics and our leadership that we have on a state level and on a federal level, to really undo what kind of got us to where we are today.
So how does the Anti-Racist Alliance address mass incarceration?
We align with a lot of different groups that are focused on decarceration, which is actually a word that's not in the dictionary, but it should be, and hopefully it will be any day now. But we are fighting for decarceration. We work with groups like Releasing Aging People from Prison, RAPP, is really, really powerful organization doing amazing work. We also do work to address solitary confinement. And then Matthew and myself are with Alternatives to Incarceration Coalition. There's also a lot of people involved in restorative justice work, which is a model and a practice that is being implemented in a lot of ways. That's repairing relationships between a victim and someone that may be charged with an offense towards that person, a violent crime maybe. So there's just a lot of things that are going on that ARA definitely aligns with, and we work with other working groups as well on this issue.
I'm gonna go back to the topic of policing for a minute. In previous interviews with the mayor of White Plains and the White Plains police chief, we asked them about the movement to defund the police. And they seem to agree that that wasn't necessary here in White Plains. Do you agree with this? And what do you think of the overall movement to defund the police?
There's a lot in that statement. The whole defund movement is obviously very controversial, where you have people arguing things from abolish to, you know, just tweaking policies and everything in between. You know, when it comes to a question of money and if the money we're spending on police couldn't be spent elsewhere to better serve the community, I would probably say that the police budget is a little bit inflated for what they're doing. And because it's inflated, they're being asked to do things that they're not really trained to do. I think the police should not get as much funding. We should be funding other organizations that train people more in how to interact with youth, for example. Like, should there be police officers in schools with guns that are able to arrest kids as young as 7 in New York because the teacher is having a hard time dealing with them? Maybe not. I don't think so. Other people might disagree with me. But from where I'm sitting, the police get a lot of money and are asked to do a lot of things that they're not trained to do. Funds might be best spent on people who are trained to support the community in other ways.
Yeah, this is always a tough one. You'll have the people on the side of the police will definitely argue that they need more money to do a better job at what they do, because training costs money, because doing a lot of different types of services or having a more trauma-informed and mental health specialist officers costs money. But for me, there's a couple big ticket items that really play a role. It's militarization of police is probably one of the biggest things that we need to address. It costs a lot of money to provide equipment and military grade vehicles to police departments. These are probably one of the biggest things that need to be addressed within police departments, because that's not what we're here to do. Now, you know, for when it comes to the other situations like training, that's also a different topic. Like Matthew said, there's a lot of different people that could be addressing issues that police respond to. So issues of mental health should definitely be prioritized to be handled by specific professionals. So defund is definitely always a complicated discussion. I would say that in a lot of ways, we definitely feel that there's so many alternatives to policing as well. So many alternatives that are cost effective. And we've seen that in a lot of different initiatives throughout the nation. And we're hoping that here in New York State, we can start to adopt some of these initiatives. In the meantime, we're also very, very focused on accountability and implementing support systems like a civilian complaint review board that would also just boost transparency and accountability of the police that we do have in place now.
Yeah, just to comment on a couple things Patrick said, it's not just necessarily thinking about, you know, who can we replace police with? Anne, who we mentioned earlier, who has been doing, you know, youth justice work for 50 years, her model for trying to get Woodfield shut down was to run them out of business. So how do you run a jail out of business? You stop sending kids to jail. right? So the question of, you know, like we're just reacting to 911 calls versus why are people calling 911 in the first place? Like, why don't communities have the support systems they need so that they're not calling 911, right? So how do we address those concerns too, which really has nothing to do with policing, right? The policing is the band-aid that might not even stick to your skin sometimes, right? And just cause a ton more harm. Whereas like food insecurity and access to mental health services and access to after-school activities and, you know, all the things that, you know, why does Northern Westchester and the very white areas in Westchester, why do they not have an issue with policing? Because they have plenty of resources to address other things with. Whereas the non-white areas that are a little more poor or significantly poorer, right? Where are those resources? Where are their extracurriculars that are helping support the people who are living there?
Could you explain what other alternatives to policing might look like?
So alternatives to policing, I guess, for me is like, you know, what do we replace police officers with? You know, if they're responding to mental health crises and then shooting people instead of getting them to the hospital or in the schools, right? Like there are alternative professionals who can take the role of that a lot of the time. But if we're talking about like what are the alternatives to incarceration, that's a very different conversation, right? Like the alternatives to incarceration really goes down to, you know, how do we respond when, you know, someone causes harm to someone else? And I think a lot of the times we have an idea that, you know, we have to take revenge and they have to be punished for it. And so we throw them in jail. But, you know, how does that address harms, right? How does that address the fact that you know, someone has been harmed, is traumatized, and is going to have to live with that when the person who harmed them is behind bars and they can't even talk to them a lot of the time and like ask why they did it? So, you know, restorative justice is one of those techniques. Transformative justice is one of those techniques. And there is funding that's starting to go in those places or has been there for a little while in some cases. What I guess my question is, what do you want to talk about? I'm not an expert necessarily on any of them. Patrick might be able to comment more, but what are you looking to address?
Well, it would be great to discuss all of those things, but for now, could one of you explain more specifically what restorative justice is?
In typical forms of criminal justice, what we do is we focus on the person that has been accused or has been the offender in a situation, right? A lot of times what we don't do is focus on the person that was the victim, especially in violent situations. Now, restorative justice has a newer lens of focusing on the offender, the victim, and the community, all three together, to repair what's happened and to try to move forward. They're trying to reduce harm, trying to reduce stigma. And what that does is a lot of times, all this time that we've been having violent crimes, murders, shootings, whatever's happening, that's these really violent situations, we're not addressing the victims and we're not repairing that relationship between victims and offenders. So what happens in that state, in the state of what our country is in now, is that a lot of things are fear-based or a lot of things are stereotypes on like specific groups, right? Specific groups, the way people look, the way, who people are, where they live. So it's not just this focus on the offender. It's a focus on all three aspects of the puzzle and really trying to repair things and move forward. So that's probably what makes it the most unique to me.
Right before we end, I have one more question. Previously, we have spoken to all our guests about the Blue Lives Matter movement in response to Black Lives Matter. Many guests we have spoken to, especially members of government, seem to respect both movements equally. What is your perspective on this issue?
that flag and Blue Lives Matter has definitely been identified as a statement that, you know, now that it's been used in all these incidents like the Capitol riot, there are police chiefs throughout the nation that are putting up a stand and they're saying, while on duty, you cannot have this in the office, you cannot have this flag on the vehicles or anything of any sort, because it is now identified to be linked to a lot of groups of hate. So I'm definitely going to send you that article, and I definitely support the police chiefs here in Westchester County making a stand for that as well. And if they don't, I think that that's a statement in itself. So I'm hoping that, you know, some of our local police chiefs will address that.
Yeah, I had an encounter with Yonkers police. I was a witness to something that happened, very minor. The leading officer comes out of his car and puts on a Blue Lives Matter mask. Like, immediately, that's the first thing you saw. These three guys getting out of their car. It was a horrible situation, and it was just like a fender bender in a parking lot. I mean, talk about signaling danger to the people involved. It was terrifying.
Well, Patrick Shelley and Matthew Kaufman, it has been so, so interesting and inspiring to speak with both of you today. Thank you so much for joining me and speaking about your experiences and perspectives on these complex issues. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to the last episode of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between. This has been truly inspiring work, and we are so glad we got to share this podcast with you.